Okay, we're going to I'm going to call the meeting to order. At this time, could you read the script for this evening?
Absolutely. Welcome. If you lose connection at any time, reconnect by clicking the link in your email invite. Committee members, please activate your video and keep it on for the duration of the meeting. Use the raise hand feature if you wish to speak, ask questions, or request a roll call vote. City staff, please activate your video when you are speaking. Use the raise hand feature when you are asked a question. Public members, the name you entered in Zoom must match the name you entered in registration. You will remain muted until called upon by the chair. Please do not use your video. Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. At this time, could you do a roll call of commissioners, please?
Yes, absolutely. Commissioner Claude Gilmore.
Present.
Gilmore, present. Commissioner Dwayne Gray.
Present.
Gray,
Present.
present. Commissioner Greg Reed. Reed, not present. Commissioner Madeline O'Connor.
Present.
O'Connor, present. Commissioner Mary Strickland.
Present.
Strickland, present. Alder Isidore Knox. Knox, not present. Alder Tag Evers.
Here.
Evers, present. Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. This time, I'd like a motion and a second for the minutes from our December 12th meeting. Is there a motion for
So
approval?
moved,
Second.
Is it moved and it's been second that the minutes from December 12th meeting be approved? We'll consider this a unanimous vote unless there are any objections. Your non-motion approved. Are there any public comments at this time, Matt?
There are no registrants for public
No,
comment.
no, no, no residents. Okay. Are there any communications?
No communications.
No communications. Are there any disclosures of recusals? Here, none. We have a couple of discussion items. The first item is a reminder about the statement of interest. Matt, go ahead.
Yep, so you should all have received emails regarding your requirement to disclose statement of interest. If you don't do this, you'll get a reminder. I'll start to get reminders. And at a certain point, if you don't do it, then you'll be asked to leave the committee. All of you are very good about doing this, but I'm required to remind you to submit those statements of interest.
Thank you very much. We next have an update on the Triangle development.
Yep. Dan, are you going to give the presentation?
Sure, be happy to. Anna, am I able to share my screen?
Yes, you should be able to. Yes.
So while Dan loads, because we're getting very close to completing the design, getting ready to start construction, I thought this would be a good time to give you a complete overview of where we are with the triangle. So, Dan, take it away.
All right, thank you. Sorry for the little load up here. So we have been meeting very regularly with all of our consultants, more or less on multiple times a week with our financial people, our design people, in anticipation of starting up with the groundbreaking for taking shape B1, which is very exciting. So just this feels like a good opportunity to remind everyone where we are in the process. So the development team, of course, our primary development partner is New Year Investments, who has taken us through from 2021 until today. Potter Lawson is, of course, our architecture partner. Baker Tilly has been our primary guides through the HUD repositioning process. And through the tax credit syndication process. So all of that has required quite a lift from the extended CDA team on this call, as well as we've identified our general contractor and construction manager in Krupp. So they have been instrumental in a lot of our meetings as of late, as well as an extended crew of additional design and engineering consultants, both through the master planning process and through detailed design up to this point. You'll recall that CDA, of course, owns the property as of today, but for a number of reasons, MRCDC was designated as the lead nonprofit development entity for purposes of securing the tax credits through WIDA, which of course we did. And so just like a number of other CDA redevelopment properties, this will be developed under the auspices of a single purpose LLC, which has been created, taking shape B1 LLC. MRCDC will, you know, be the managing member and the CDA will be the on-site property manager. We have identified our investor manager in the NAF Corporation, and so we have our permanent financing coming through them and through U.S. Bank and a number of other parties. And you'll see in green here that MRCDC and New Year in the end will be splitting the development fee for the first phase 60-40, with 60% going to MRCDC upon closing and build out. So again, a reminder that CDA owns approximately 10 acres at the Triangle, the unshaded areas through the center of the property. Starting, of course, with the Brittingham site and the green space, open space, just immediately to the north. That will be our first development phase, followed by Gay Braxton and Parkside and Caribous to the south. And so B1 will be that first building. So you can see that highlighted on the green space here. And that will be replacing Brittingham one for one with all of the other existing CDA buildings on the triangle being, I don't want to say consolidated, but they will be all moved into B2 and B3 from there, then freeing up those additional sites for redevelopment in the longer term. Of course, this has been emphasized by this board and numerous others that anti-displacement is a very big portion of this, and that's why it's been phased the way that it has. And the ability to add a significant amount of units beyond the 336 that exist here today, you know, a long-term estimate of about 1,200 when we're all done, really does make a big difference when addressing the city's housing shortage and really adding a whole variety of units here, both for lower income populations, but also just the city's stock in general in a really nice, attractive, well-connected area of the city. And so the emphasis here again on good human scale design is really important. The courtyards give you a sense of, you know, kind of private space while also, you know, a shared community space, if you will. So that's really been a big focus of all of our engagement with residents to date. You know, there are certainly concerns about, you know, privacy and security, but also the ability to stay connected with the broader community. And so that balancing those prerogatives has really been an emphasis of our design team and our development team, including the, you know, the long planned shared use path along the western edge of the A and B sites. So that would eventually connect the East Campus Mall all the way through campus, all the way to Brittingham Park. And that has been in city plans for a number of years here. So again, the idea is that residents would only move once. Certainly there isn't any availability in our portfolio to move folks offsite, even if we wanted to, but that would certainly be a major disruption. And you know, all of our residents have expressed trepidation, but also excitement about the opportunity here. And it's really great to actually be really close to actually getting underway here and having some tangible steps being made. One thing I want to emphasize, if we haven't before, is that Braxton Place will be going from its current loop formation, that is a one-way loop back out to Park Street, that will be shrunken down. We'll be vacating the southern part of that loop. It will go to two-way traffic, but ultimately it will be a very slow-moving street. And more importantly, it provides some additional development space for B1. So we'll have the ability to have a terrace and have that building actually front onto a street, onto a sidewalk, and have it really serve as more of a pedestrian scale entrance for folks on foot, as opposed to the current setback for Brittingham, which is across a parking lot and requires quite a bit of distance from Braxton Place, both to connect to a bus, to a sidewalk that really brings this up close to an enhanced street grid. And at the same token, we're limiting the ability of through traffic to come through here. It's not designed to be a cut through in any way, and residents have expressed a desire to keep a lot of vehicular traffic from coming through here. So the parking aisles and driveways are really limited here to just on-site traffic and for the number of visitors that come through here for service providers and such. We intend to keep the existing Asian Midway grocery store on the site. They're currently located at the corner of the very prominent site at the corner of West Wash and Park Street. They have signaled a desire to stay here. So in the long run, they would be relocated to the C site, approximately where the number 6 is right here. This will still primarily be a residential site in the long run, but having a limited amount of on-site commercial space that is resident serving is also really seen as a positive. So here are a selection of renderings for the B1 building. We think Potter Lawson has done a really nice job articulating this site and really making this building stand out. From a materials perspective, big floor-to-ceiling windows with a lot of natural light. The first floor shared community spaces are really a big prominent part of the B1 building. So the pedestrian entrances facing out onto the street frontages are really important, and we think that they've done a nice job in articulating those and making those feel more welcoming. There'll be a lot of signage and opportunities for colorful resident art and installations here to really hopefully make this feel like a community, and really help dovetail with the really nice positive aspects of art that Bayview next door has been able to incorporate into their site. So again, the phasing plan really does start with the so-called B site. At the center of the site, and then in the long run would replace Gay Braxton to the north, the A site, and then go to the southwest to Caribous Parkside and the grocery store in the long run. And certainly the B site is what we're emphasizing right now. B2 and B3, the phase two buildings are already pretty far along in their pre-design, and once we are able to get started with B1, get that under construction, our hope is that we'd be coming in for the next round of tax credits for those projects here in 2025, with that application going in around May of this year. So again, once we've had a very long lead time to get to our first phase here, but from that point, we're hoping that every year or two we would be going after additional credits, additional sources of funding to really finish off this project in an expeditious way, within the original 10-year time frame that was envisioned when we launched this project. So the B1 unit mix, again, is a one-for-one replacement of the units at Brittingham, which are primarily one-bedroom units, 163 of them, and one two-bedroom unit. And all of those through the RAD Section 18 disposition process through HUD, those public housing units will be converted to Section 8 vouchers on all of them. So again, and primarily this building will be occupied by existing Brittingham residents. So they'll have the ability to move over, and they will continue to pay the 30% of their monthly income, regardless of what that is. And our subsidy will be, pegged to 60% AMI rents. So from a tenant perspective, there is no difference. But we have the benefit of having the voucher subsidies that help us pay for the project and for our ongoing operating costs. And I will note that through WIDA and through other programs, we have committed to set asides for certain populations between veterans, disabled individuals, and seniors. So that's almost half of the units set aside for those populations, many of which are all represented in one form or another through the current population at Brittingham. So again, this allows us to serve, all of the different groups that are part of CDA's mission. As far as our sources and uses, this is as of today, a $71 million project, more or less. And so we are building out what you can see is a very complicated capital stack through a number of different sources. A good chunk of that, of course, comes from tax credit equity from federal and state sources. And we have been meeting regularly with folks from NEF, the National Equity Fund, that has invested in Revival Ridge and several other CDA properties to help us get our permanent financing together. So through CPC, we have lined up our permanent financing, the $12 million or so through Freddie Mac tax-exempt loan, a smattering of other sources for sustainability credits, the Section 48, Section 45L, GGRF, which is a new loan program available through the US EPA, and then certainly a large portion of funds that have been earmarked for the project from the City of Madison. So we have home funds, we have some expiring emergency rental assistance funds set aside for this project, and then we have the ability to deploy some TIF funds and affordable housing funds for additional gap filling as may be needed. Though we're hoping to save some of those finite funds for future phases. And then certainly there are development fees and reserves deployed here as well. Previous iterations of this pro forma had shown that we were going after a large geothermal component that if we had needed to build the entire thing up front, it would have been a pretty significant outlay of $14, $15 million or so. We have determined through test bores that we are able to build this geothermal component under each building as opposed to having to build it all up front. So we are realizing at least some savings up front by doing it in this phased manner and not having to find all those dollars up front. But so as of right now, this is the capital stack that we're rolling with and are looking hopefully to get to a financial closing on the tax credit funds and other sources here by the first part of April. And just some notes about the project itself and our larger goals here around sustainability. Certainly, that's a big push on the city side for everything that we do, and the CDA is certainly committed to those goals as well as far as net zero and everything that we can do on the residential side. Because if we can't do it, we can't really ask other people to do it in any meaningful way. And so that includes things like going to all electric wherever we can, getting away from non-renewables, getting away from natural gas, finding new ways to deploy geothermal on the leading edge where we can, and then certainly from the long run, reducing both CDA's operational costs, but also limiting the utility costs for our residents. So it's a win-win situation when we're able to deploy sustainability in everything that we do. And so there's a number of different things that we've done specifically on that efficiency and sustainability front. The renewables, geothermal, solar. All of our roofs will be ready for solar when we're able to fund those things. The city's net 100% net zero goals remain top of mind. And certainly, we want this geothermal project to be something of a demonstration project for other residential sites in the city. Again, property management will be handled by existing CDA staff. We're working on a new tenant selection plan that is consistent with the CDD division's new and upgraded standards. Affirmative marketing will always, as it is today, focus on meaningful efforts to identify income-eligible people. And certainly our CDA staff are well-versed in making sure that our affirmative fair housing marketing plans are consistent with all federally subsidized housing standards. And as far as supportive services, the service coordinator program that exists on site today has been very successful. We get referrals from the VASH program, for veterans living at the Triangle, and of course the Edgewood Nursing Program and the Triangle Community Ministry have both been longstanding partners with offices and a presence at the at Brittingham and the Triangle more broadly, and so they have signaled their intent to stay involved in the project through redevelopment as well. So we have designed our community spaces and shared spaces to accommodate those additional service providers as well. So again, we are closing in on all of our design and land use approval milestones, which is terrific. Geothermal testing has been ongoing, and we want to get our arms around the exact cost of such, but the test bores that were completed within the last few weeks have been encouraging. All of this really points towards a target date of around April 1st to close on all of our financing and to get going on meaningful construction progress on the site. And the estimate is that this could take 18 to 24 months to complete for building B1, with ultimate delivery of the project and an opening in late 2026 or the first part of 2027. And with that, I will end here and open it to questions.
Claude, tag
yes. Has a yeah, go ahead.
Thanks, Chair. And thanks, Dan, for this helpful and informative presentation. Regarding the design that Potter Lawson have come up with, I'm wondering what level of resident engagement took place in terms of feedback on the design. I ask this because the design qualities that you see at Bayview were very much a result of a high level of resident engagement. The colors, the materials, the lots of different things, and they went back and forth several times to be able to make sure that residents were comfortable and happy with the way, you know, these units would look on the inside and the outside. So I'm wondering if you can address that. I think it's hard to say from those pictures really what they look like. You say you think that they've done a good job with the design. I don't know how they're going to look next to Bayview's very colorful use of palettes and colors, and I'm just wondering, and I have a couple follow-up questions once you respond to that.
Sure. So certainly through the master plan process, Potter was really tasked with finding ways to engage with residents and get their feedback on the things that they'd like about their current units, those things that they would like to see. So there were a number of charrettes that were done building by building over the course of that master planning process to really get those kind of high level feedback items.
Right.
And then from there, they were drilling down more specifically on a lot of the accessibility components, because yes, I mean, just the level of need for some folks from a physical perspective was really a thing that we needed to address here. So there have been discussions around, you know, the openings of windows, where those things go, countertop heights, you know, certainly other, you know, ADA type components around doorway widths, things like that. And there have been, you know, smaller conversations with residents around those specific items. So thinking about Caribous, for example, just because the needs of those residents are just so specific. So that has really been important to realize. And WIDA also requires a lot of kind of higher level design things that through Enterprise Green Communities, you know, certainly LEED was looked at. So not only from a sustainability perspective, but also, you know, that accessibility is a big portion of that as well.
So also, what you don't see in those renderings is the public art pieces, because those will come later.
Yeah.
And as part of the engagement, a lot of the, I think the emphasis was to simplify the building, put color into the public art, and then inside the building, color is used a lot for wayfinding, given the complexity of the buildings and some of the needs of our individuals to have solid wayfinding.
Well, I appreciate that. That was a follow-up question about public art. But do you know if residents were able to pick or will be able to say if they want the inside, the interior of their units to be a certain color, or did they have some, you spoke to functionality, you spoke to sustainability, but, you know, just in terms of, you know, the overall feel and look of the interior and exterior of the buildings, were the residents engaged in that, or were these not compared to things like functionality and counter heights and accessibility, perhaps not as important? Do you know?
I think we had a number of those charrettes, and I will say it was much more about layout, function. Those were definitely
the priority.
More of the priority.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And lastly, about usable green space, could you, you talked about some of these courtyards. Will there be gardens? Will there be vegetable gardens, flower gardens, an opportunity for people to, you know, sit in outdoors and walk and exercise, perhaps, any outdoor recreational spaces? I know that there's some kind of a tight space, but what are, in terms of usable green space and a sense of, you know, connection to nature, et cetera, how can we incorporate, or is that being incorporated sufficiently in your mind in the design that we have here?
Dan, do you want to go?
Sure. Yeah. So Psyche Design has handled a lot of the landscaping elements of that, including the courtyard spaces. And so they do try to strike a balance between programmed and unprogrammed space. So there are definitely some, you know, larger lawn areas that allow folks to kind of sit and have quiet, but then we also wanted to have some spaces that are a bit more activated for gathering, and certainly for sitting, larger functions, et cetera, but also raised flower beds, garden beds were also part of that. So it'll be a little bit of everything.
Yep, we heard a lot about people wanted grilling areas, so we've incorporated that. There are specific view sheds that are carved out between the buildings to have lake views heading towards the Capitol. Those sorts of things were carved out. And as Dan said, there's meandering walking paths that go through. And the courtyard is pretty substantial when you add the B1 with B2 and B3 when it all comes combined.
Well, thank you. And I have to say thank you, Dan and Matt, for all your hard work here. It's really exciting to see this come along and that we may be breaking ground and cutting a ribbon in April or May. That's just so exciting. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Commissioner Strickland, go ahead.
Dan, can we get a copy, or will it be put up onto the, you know, the website of the slide deck? I'd like to see a copy if I could. And secondly, are there some RETA applications that were due, tax credit applications in January for the next building? You mentioned May. I thought there were some that were due in January.
You are correct that it is now a two-step process as of the most recent QAP. So we were required to put in a pre-application, if you will, that really just included, you know, evidence of site control and a very rough pro forma for the buildings B2 and B3. Assuming that we have a, you know, kind of rough scoring and we are invited by WETA to go through a full underwriting, that's what we would then submit in May of this year.
Okay, and lastly, the council approved, I think it was last year, a new tenant selection process. Are the current tenants and future tenants aware of this new tenant selection process? I'm thinking in particular that some tenants can have, you know, criminal records within, or I guess after 5 years, some serious criminal records will be maybe their neighbors. I mean, is this being, this information I just think has to be you know, transmitted to the existing tenants and the future tenants that this process, tenant selection process, has changed and become a little bit more lenient.
So we've been going through the exercise of taking the tenant selection plan criteria that comes from CDD and making sure it's still compliant with all of the things that are in Section 8. So the Section 8 criteria trumps the tenant selection plan. So So those federal rules are still the rules we have to follow. So this is much more about just tenant selection plan. It doesn't change a lot of how we have to do things, but we're making sure it's compatible. So that's actually being worked on right now. So we've not shared anything specific with tenants because that exercise isn't done, making sure we know how those two things work together.
And what you're saying is that the existing Section 8 criteria that we've been using over the last many years, that criteria trumps the local ordinance?
Yeah. So it'll still change some of our internal practices, but it won't change we still have to follow the federal rules. Yep.
Okay. Thank you. That's it. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Griffin. Alder Knox, go ahead.
Thank you. Could we bring up those renderings again? First of all, first of all, I just want to say that I really appreciate these renderings on the project. I'm definitely envious of the scale as it relates to, you know, the project in my district. So I like that they're much, you know, height is much more modest and that. I guess I have an opportunity the last couple of weeks to transport about three individuals that's staying in the current building right now. And so obviously they had several questions about the project. So one of them was, can you tell me what, and I might have missed this in the presentation, but what is the building occupancy process in terms of moving into the new buildings? Can you kind of briefly explain that? I apologize if I missed that in the presentation.
So people will only move once. And one of the things we are working through between now and closing is the relocation process. So our consultants have been interviewing relocation specialists, moving companies, to put together the plan for how exactly that will happen. So I don't have answers for you because we literally had a meeting about it this morning. But this is what we heard loud and clear from people, is that the moving part is the physical moving is very stressful. And so we've been putting a lot of energy into getting a very solid plan to help them relocate. And so there will be a dedicated relocation consultant that will be on the team when we get to that point.
And then they'll make sure they inform the residents of what that process is as it starts. I got plenty of questions on that.
I'm sure you did. It's been a constant conversation with tenants because it's a concern.
Yeah. And then the other thing they talked about, and I can't tell, you know, because the renderings are kind of far back, but they mentioned wondering if there will be balconies or terraces. And I don't know if that's as opposed to the courtyard and green space. Can someone kind of talk about that? Or is there a picture that gives me a better visual of that? Or are we not at that point yet?
So individual units won't have balconies, but there will be some units that do open up to the courtyard if they're on the internal side of the building.
Okay.
And then there will be some first floor units that will have their own exits. So there will be a number of those. So it just depends on what side of the building, what floor you're on, if you have, you know, the direct access to the outside.
Okay. Because that was a big conversation. You know, the ladies I transport are all senior ladies, obviously, and they talk about wanting to be able to, you know, walk out, get some fresh air without having to, you know what I mean, maybe go down and out of the building. So that was one of the questions, and I didn't have the answer to that. Does that kind of not fit the model of what we're designing now, or what?
Well, so there's a, I guess there's a handful of issues in, on the on the balcony side. One is there's a maintenance just issue with them. Second, there's some energy efficiency things that come with that. So the size of your window openings versus door openings has a big effect on the energy side of things. So we had to be very careful with how much glass and opening that we had to get enough light to make it nice and attractive, but also to meet our energy requirements. And balconies make some of that more challenging. We, for first floor units, as much as possible, we tried to get them their own entrance and exits. But yeah, a lot of those upper units, they just have windows. They don't have a door and a balcony to them, which the current, every building on the site right now is a little bit different on how that works as well.
Okay. That was one thing they really were talking about, just for, not just for aesthetics, but, you know, for functionality. So I guess I can let them know that. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Alder Knox. Commissioner Gray, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, John. And thank you, Waitcha, obviously, for this presentation and providing us with an overview of some of the things that certainly is still kind of unfolding as part of this huge, huge project. So I guess the first question for me is that, just because I actually am a resident in the community and I oftentimes frequent Brittingham, I am aware that Potter and Lawson has some pictures that's kind of displayed over in the building that kind of give some kind of overview of what the parameters will be in the rooms and things. And so I'm just wondering, is there any way we can kind of look at some of those slides that they have over there in the building that's part of this process, to give us more of a visual of what the rooms look like and some of the other things that really hit home in terms of looking at how the buildings are designed? Can you give us any visuals on any of that at this point?
Dan, do you have them handy? I've got just kind of block room diagrams handy from Anastasia.
You have extensive floor plans for each building, which even at this scale are somewhat tough to read, honestly. And we do have some unit-specific renderings or floor plans, if you will. So let me see if I can pull something up quickly.
Thank you. You know, I just think it's helpful as part of the presentations if we can really see more specific elements of some of the design plans. I like what Commissioner Everest, you know, asked about. What were some of the things that the resident kind of looked at? And I was a part of the Bayview process and looking at the level of engagement with the residents and the architects, it's certainly different from this process, but I understand this is a much larger process.
You able to locate anything?
So while he's looking for that, maybe I could ask another question too, because I don't want to take up too much time. John, all this is going to do is be more confusing for me. I mean, I would like for us to see the designs that they have already over at Brittingham, which gives us more of a picture of what the rooms actually looks like, the sizes and dimensions and things of that nature. So do you guys have the pictures that you have displayed in Brittingham for the residents to display?
I don't have those handy, though I did actually just contact Potter Lawson this afternoon asking for updated renderings, just because we wanted to have more of these kind of conversations that are more visual. So, you know, sitting where we sit in real estate and planning, we have a lot more of these kind of technical drawings, but I'm hoping to have a new set of interior and exterior renderings to share with you all and through our communication process more broadly here very soon.
Thanks, John. So I guess my next question is, when I think about the low-income housing tax credits, how much of this project will be funded by the government? Can you guys give me a percentage?
Sure. So the tax credits pay for roughly half of it.
Okay.
And then, the affordable housing tax credits pay for half the building.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
the energy or like tax credits are another $2 million and change. Yeah. And then we have a very, very low interest loan related to our energy features. And that's about $7.5 million. So when you add those pieces together, you're at $42 to $45 million is coming from federal sources related to affordability
yeah.
or sustainability. Then it's there's federal money that flows through the city of Madison. That's
right,
another
right.
$10 million. So it looks like it's a loan from the city, but it's really mm-hmm. federal money that goes to the city and comes to us.
Okay.
So, and then we're able to hold to support some debt. So there's a loan on it for about $12 million. The amount of local money going into it is going to be maybe $2 million of city funds coming from TIF, so tax incremental financing. And then the CDA itself mm-hmm. is only putting in somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million. And that's actually, that money is your reserves at the building yeah. that is just being transferred over to the new property. So from the CDA's balance sheet, you're not really spending any of your money, any of your unrestricted money.
Well, and that's good to know. So from the federal government, do you have a percentage of how much money you guys are anticipating to receive from the federal government for this particular project, phase one?
What do you mean, what do you mean receive? Like that'll come to back to the CDA or?
Yeah, to pay for this particular housing project, how much money will you guys estimate to be receiving from HUD, from the federal government?
Okay, so well, so it's confusing because some of it's not all HUD, but we'll say just from the federal government directly. Let's see, 35. We'll say $50 million is coming from the federal government in some program or another, roughly.
Or another. Okay, and that's a good estimate. So I appreciate you saying that, Mr. Witcher. So have you guys have had any discussions around? Now, just what if? Now, again, I want to see this project be successful. I want to make sure all the monies can be allocated from the various sources. But have you guys discussed the fact that obviously I know that we are switching guards in terms of the government. We're going to be under new leadership. Is there any discussion around, well, what if some of the funding isn't available? What is there some discussion around a possible backup plan to this?
Yep. So between now and March when we close, most of this money has already come out of the federal government and come to the city, or it's been allocated, or it's sitting with like the energy money. Most of it is actually sitting at this financial institution to be lent out. So once we get to closing, that money is sort of, it's to us. There's little risk of it going away. It's really when you get to phase two and three, that's when we would be in a possible different world where things like our energy tax credits might not exist when we go to apply for them in a year for phases two and three. Like we might have a financial gap open up on phases two and three because programs that filled our financial gap today won't be there a year from now when we have a financial gap on phases two and three.
Okay. Thanks. I don't have any further questions at this time. Thank you.
Claude, you're muted.
Yeah, there's no further questions. This has been a very helpful presentation. Thank you for.
Oh, you're muted again.
With this thing. Anna, can you move to the next item on the agenda? Because I'm shifting between screens.
Yeah, absolutely. The next item is update on the CDA strategic plan.
Okay.
So I can cover that one.
Yeah.
I'm just going to quickly go through sort of where we are progress-wise from items we talked about at the strategic planning session roughly 6 months ago.
Yes.
All right. So if you remember, we talked about changes to our structure, creating a charter based on our mission, our work plan, and portfolio analysis. So when it comes to the structure of the CDA, we spent the last 2 years going through a reorganization, and that's pretty much complete. And that was really with the hiring of Sadie as our client services manager. We now have a management team, and there's just a handful of positions that in Lisa's unit that need to be filled and still have a couple of changes that could be made there. But otherwise, the reorganization of the staff is complete. We are currently working with HR on the process to hire a deputy director. So there's some changes to that position that need to get approved by the Common Council, and that'll happen over the next month, and then we will be out to hire. So that's all in process to hire that position. Hopefully, you know, that'll only take a few months, and then Lynette can return to Community Development Division and we'll have a new deputy director for the CDA. And then the City Attorney's Office has drafted a agreement between CDA and MRCDC that'll really define how management happens between it, because MRCDC does not have staff. It relies on CDA staff to do everything. So that's being spelled out in an agreement. It's been drafted, staff are reviewing. So this will likely come to you in the first quarter to approve. And that'll really formalize how properties and staffing and money gets handed off between MRCDC and the CDA going forward. Because right now it's all kind of a one-off situation, and this would be a master agreement to cover that relationship. So that's what's happening on the structure side of the CDA. As you remember, we talked about taking the mission statement that you approved, your equity statement, and some of those key lessons from the master plan and mushing them together to create a charter that outlines really what is the CDA doing and how does it want to do development going forward. So this, I'll be honest, we haven't done a lot with since we talked. And what I was hoping to get is feedback from the board about how you want to kind of chew through this document to get it into a kind of a final form. And so one thing I could do is I could just send you each individually the draft document, and you can read it. You can send me back comments you have, and then we can take it up at a future meeting to adopt those comments. So that's one way to do it. Alternatively, we could take over the next 4 or 5 months, we could reserve the last 30 minutes of each meeting and cover a section. So we could cover, how are you going to handle sustainability? How are you going to handle, you know, what are your priorities for development going forward? And we could just take it piece by piece. Then staff could take it back, take those comments, give you a final draft. Or alternatively, if you just want to chew through the whole document, we could have a special meeting where we take an hour and a half. You could suspend the rules and have more of a discussion about the document. These are just my three ideas as to how you can edit this, because we don't usually spend a lot of time editing documents as a group, but I think this is sort of a substantive document with a lot of connected pieces. So I would be open to any feedback on how the board wants to take that up. I can keep going and we can come back to this, or Chair, if you want to talk about this now, we can do that.
Well, I think I'd like to at least get some initial reaction from the board. And are there any hands up, anybody who wants to offer any comments?
I send the draft. Send us a draft.
Okay. Draft.
I support in having the draft sent to as well.
Alder Knox has his hand raised.
Go ahead, Alder Knox.
Yeah, I think sending the draft is fine. But I also, and I don't know if I have a preference for what you're, for these other issues. It does seem that it would be productive once we get the draft to look at taking it piece by piece, 30 minutes after each meeting to discuss it. But I don't have a preference there. But I was just wondering if, and I remember when we went through this plan before, would we be able to have not, you know, some general plan for each area or section of CDA housing that we're planning? It obviously wouldn't be a master plan because that's more defined, but just general plan. I'll give you an example. What's our plan in 5 years for the properties on Baird Street? Are we? You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
You know what I'm getting at, Matt?
Yep. So separately, and I'll give an update on that. We're hiring Baker mm-hmm. Tilly to help analyze all of those.
Yeah.
That'll be, think of it like a supplement. So yeah. So the charter is kind of like, how do you want to do your business? And then we'll have a more specific kind of, you know, master work plan. Yep.
Okay. Cause I think maybe in different areas, we kind of want to figure out what's next. You know what I mean?
That sounds good. Commissioner O'Connor, you also agree with the send the draft?
Yes, I think that would be much more efficient. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think once we've sent the draft back, Matt, at that point, we can set up a specific part of the meeting to kind of talk about, give us a response back. And then we can digest to say, okay, should we take a portion of certain meetings to sort of do a milestone check-in? How are we doing these things? So that could be a periodic, you know, every couple of months, a report back.
And Alder Evers has his hand up.
Go ahead, Alder Evers.
Thanks, Chair. I think the way to go, in my opinion, is that you do send us this draft, give us a chance to look at it and comment on it. And then if we need additional follow-up discussions, we can reserve time for that. But let's not commit to that until we see the draft.
Okay. Yep. It's about an 8 to 10 page paper. So I can get that out to you in the next week.
Oh, that sounds good. All appreciate right. that.
Thanks for the feedback.
Yeah. Next item, Anna.
Oh, we got more of this.
Okay. Continue.
So, work plan. If you recall, we've sort of laid out all of the things that are really slated for major construction over the next 5 years, and we've been working this work plan. This gets updated every year. So Dan and I are in the process, and the rest of the staff are in the process of updating this for 2025, but just notable things that are actively being worked on and that have changed in the last 6 months is for Park Badger. The master plan was adopted at the end of the year. We've spent the last month or so working on the actual development agreement with Alexander Company. They just sent us back comments today. We'll have some back and forth with the attorneys over the next couple of weeks. And so hopefully at your February meeting, you'll be seeing a development agreement that would really allow us to move ahead, start applying for tax credits, keep chugging ahead with design on it so that we can, be talking about, groundbreaking, a year or so from now. As Dan said, Triangle B1 heading towards construction start in the next couple of months. Triangle B2 and 3, as we talked about, it's a two-step tax credit application. Step one is done. We're waiting for feedback, which we think will come the third week of January, to know if we're invited to do the second step of the tax credit application for B2, B3. The one thing to note here that changed from the master plan is, as we got deeper into analysis, instead of applying for tax credits on B2 and separately applying for B3, we submitted one tax credit application. And what this lets it would give us slightly less tax credits, but we would save $1 million+ on duplicative administrative fees and soft costs. So it was a wash. And it eliminates the risk that we would get credits on one building, but not get credits on the other and some other things. So this was just a simpler path to do a single tax credit application. Teresa Terrace is under construction. So when we get closer to opening, we'll plan a ribbon cutting event. All of you will be invited to that. When the building is open, take a tour, all of those things. Framing, sort of got everything got closed in the last week or so, which is good for winter. So now they can start working on the rest of the building now that all of the framing in general, sealing the building up has been done. And then for your tax credit, your current tax credit properties, Revival Ridge, Burr Oaks, Truax Phase 1, we've engaged an attorney to start the process of taking those through the unwinding of the tax credits, so they'll no longer be owned by your LLCs. Instead, they'd be owned by MRCDC. So expect approvals and refinancings and those sorts of things to start coming in 2025. That's where you'll see it, is the approval of some of those things. As Alder Knox mentioned, we're engaging Baker Tilly to do an analysis of the portfolio. We internally have pulled what's the current building condition, what do the neighborhood plans call for, is it in a TIF district, is there special financing available based on the type of building or geography, and then we have to internally have to look at our own staff capacity to do projects. This got put on pause because the person at Baker Tilly who was leading this was on leave. We saw her today. She's back in the office. So we're going to re-engage on this process this quarter. So once we have a scope of work, where you'll probably see this as a contract that would get approved to work with Baker Tilly to do that work. And then Commissioner Strickland has her hand up.
Go ahead, Commissioner Strickland.
Nope, you're on mute. Mary, you're muted.
Sorry, I don't know if this is the right point, but one of my questions regarding the MRCDC relationship with CDA is, what percentage of CDA units do we anticipate eventually moving over to MRCDC? Mm-hmm. Of the 700 plus units that we own? And secondly, the Section 8 certificate, the voucher program, you know, over 2000 vouchers, whatever, is any of that program targeted to be moved to MRCDC? And lastly, is there a way to speed up any applications, or maybe actually it's too late for that, but are there any program monies available at the federal level as this transition happens that we should have been maybe in the past tense or should be applying for, if those pools of money are available, are not going to be touched, maybe not new funding allocated, but existing funding?
To your first question, eventually it's likely all of your housing assets could move over to MRCDC, because as you switch to vouchers, we need to have them outside of the CDA. So each time you do a redevelopment, it's going to move to MRCDC. So eventually it could be everything. We've got flexibility in certain cases, but that is a likely outcome, is that you would move all of your housing to MRCDC to just hold the real estate. The Section 8 program, though, will stay with the CDA, because that's who the federal government is contracting through is the CDA to run the Section 8 voucher program. And then to the question about these federal resources that could be going away, we were just selected today by Bloomberg to get technical assistance in trying to get more of the greenhouse gas reduction funds, some of these very specific funds that have a specific shelf life, looking at, you know, what can we do to make sure that, you know, we're meeting the right standards to be eligible for them and do some of that work. So they sent us a letter today to say that we were selected to get to the next round to get that technical assistance.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate that, thank you. Go ahead, Matt, any your further presentation?
Nope, that's it.
You know, other questions for Matt? I think this is very helpful, what you've laid out for us and given us sort of a check-in. I think periodically, this is helpful to kind of see where we're going and then what the future looks like.
I do not see any hands raised at this time.
Next item on the agenda.
The next item is the report on housing authority operations.
Okay, Lynette, are you going to make that?
I am. Everyone sees the report on my screen and not my email. That's always my biggest fear. So the update from, and for those that don't know me, I'm Lynette Rhodes. I'm the interim deputy director for the next 4 to 6 months in CDA. So happy to be here. So up on my screen is the occupancy report. The kind of only thing I would point out from changes from last time we looked at this report to this time, there was an increase in vacant units for the West units. However, those units are vacant right now on this report because they soon will be moved to the offline units. And those units are set to be in the category of getting modernization. So our staff remain committed to quickly filling units, but making sure that the units have quality standards as well. So that is the only kind of data point I would point out on this report. I will pause and see if there's any questions.
Occupancy rate relative to the percentage is still good. Is there everything between 98% and plus?
Yep. We still have a good occupancy rate, and yeah. Staff are working on filling the vacant units that they do have applications for.
That's good.
All right. So the next report is the voucher report. Again, very similar to the last report, they are working on keeping individuals recertified, going through. This is where Matt just mentioned, I'll just make a note, part of the reorg, Sadie is now the client services manager. She soon will be posting for the Section 8 supervisor and for a housing specialist to help with the voucher program. So if you have anyone interested in helping us make sure that we keep these utilization numbers and work with that unit, I think it is a great opportunity for people to engage with CDA. But the numbers are about the same that they were last month. So I'll pause to see if there's any questions.
So question on that one. So how has our vouchers changed over the year? Relative to just the beginning and the end.
Sadie, do you want to have, since you have a little bit more history, do you want to answer that, please?
Sure thing. So if you look at, I guess the biggest part would be look at January on the voucher utilization rate, which is about in the middle of the report. That shows that we were at about 87% of our vouchers are being utilized. And then if you go over to December, that same line, we're at 92% utilization. You can also look at the line below that is the housing assistance payments. We were at about $1.5 million a month in January. And now we're getting really close to 1.7 million. So we've definitely been spending a lot more money, and we have definitely been helping a larger number of families in Madison.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Any questions from commissioners on this?
I do not see any hands raised.
All right, the final report then is we were asked to bring the delinquency report. So on my screen now is the delinquency report that was produced. You can see overall in public housing, there is about...
I don't think we see that yet on the screen.
Well, let's stop share and then share again and see if it comes up now. Is it there now?
It is here now. Yeah.
Okay. So as you can see, there is about 75 households total in public housing, 20 in the multifamily, one in the Truex project-based voucher. So overall, 96 households in total. If you look on the right side of the screen, there are about 111 households that are currently behind, but they are in a repayment plan. In looking at this report, again, putting my community development division hat on and talking with CDA staff as well, I just wanted to point out a few things about kind of delinquency and some of the programs that we have within the city, especially in the fact of what we saw during the pandemic. So as you might know, the city received emergency rental assistance funds, which then we worked with the county and community programs to set up various rental assistance programs. So our first programs that came through the city, we called them CORE programs. CORE stood for, it was a long acronym for the program, but it was all about helping individuals who were affected by the pandemic to pay their rent. We spent in city limits about, through the City of Madison's Community Development Division, about $45 million for that program. When it was kind of time to shift from that general will help people pay their rent, we closed that program in 2023, and we funded only an eviction defense and diversion partnership. The major change with that program from CORE to the eviction defense and diversion is that we will only provide rental assistance for the overall city programs once someone has an eviction filing. That program has been operating now with our partnership with Tenant Resource Center since 2021. That program will be closing soon as well. We soon will be doing a lot of press announcements. So I thought this was relevant to kind of mention it in relation to this kind of report. We plan on notifying all former and current program participants of that program, doing press release, doing some town halls. Because one of the things we think is really important and what we have kind of seen through the pandemic is, unfortunately, some tenants have not taken advantage of opportunities like payment plans or communicating with their property manager about their delinquency issues, and instead are kind of hoping and working with these programs in order to help fund some of the back rent that is owed. And as the program closes, we want to make sure that people know that the most important thing that they can be doing at this time, when we do not have these rental resources available anymore, is talking to their property manager and making sure that those opportunities for a payment plan are created if the programs are no longer available. So I just wanted to kind of mention that update of the program And happy to provide more updates of that program closure, the impacts of how that will happen and the impacts and communication to tenants as that program closes as well in relation to how it affects delinquency.
So the question there is, does that mean that of those people that are in that mix, would they be people who are not going to be able to make that, and are those people subject to be evicted?
So right now, I mean, if individuals are delinquent, they are subject to having an eviction filed from the CDA because that is a lease violation. They can then, if the eviction is filed at this time, be enrolled in that program and receive assistance from Tenant Resource Center. And so it is an opportunity for the CDA to kind of communicate in a way with that tenant of you are not abiding by your lease. We need to file this eviction so you can go get help from Tenant Resource Center. And then hopefully through that process, that tenant is understanding that this is a resource that is available to them at this time. But then, you know, prioritizing in the fact that that funding will not be there in the future for them, potentially.
So do you have anybody now that's in the subject to eviction?
Lauren, I'm going to pause and ask if you have any overall information about evictions.
I don't have the information offhand. We did just come across our January rent that was due on the 5th. So we're in the process of going through our most current delinquency numbers and determining if what notices we have to issue. So we're not at the court phase, I don't believe, with anybody right now.
Okay.
And it looks like Commissioner Gray has his hand raised.
Commissioner Gray, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. Thanks, Lynette, obviously, for certainly providing an overview on this and then talking about some of the things that CDA will be doing, you know, prior to moving forward. And, you know, and I think one of the things, too, that I have noticed is that I kind of been on this board for about 5 years. And it just seems to me that there have not been at least one eviction based on delinquent rent payments. And I just can't wrap my mind around that as someone who's been living in CDA housing for nearly 20 plus years, because I think the first line of defense legally is when people do not pay their rent payment, there's a letter that's automatically generated that says you can be evicted and you will be going through the process. So I just think there's a disconnect somewhere along the line that if someone is being evicted for not paying their rent, that there's, I just don't understand why that's such a big issue with CDA and not having to be able to give us these numbers. It's almost, you know, it's like a glass ceiling that has been set. But moving forward, I think if a person is not being responsible for paying their rent, and they're going through the courts and they have all the other programs available for them, they should be subject to evictions. And I think it's fair for us as commissioners to understand that that's just a reality of life. So I do hope at some point that if someone is evicted under the new criteria, that we can have access to that information. It also will help this chart too as well, because when we look at these delinquent payments, it just doesn't seem like this chart is really consistent with the language that we're actually hearing at this time. Thank you.
Chair, it looks like Commissioner Strickland has her hand raised.
Go ahead, Commissioner Strickland.
You're muted still.
Sorry, Lynette, I just wanted to clarify. We have 96 people, households that are delinquent, and we have a separate 111 households that have a repayment agreement, correct?
Yes. Let me just clarify. Lauren.
Let me jump in there real quick.
Yeah,
some of the 111, or excuse me, some of the 95 households are included in that 75 that's delinquent. So there are quite a few people who are delinquent and not paying on the repayment agreements.
Wait. There are some of the 96 that are included in the 111, you're saying?
So I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong number. Yes, there some of that 96 is included in the 111.
Well, that's an important understanding that we need to understand that clearly, because so of the 96, some of them are, and can you tell us what number of the 96 have a repayment plan?
I don't have it at this very moment, but I could put that together.
Well, if you could email us or something, I mean, that's kind of important to know. We got 96 delinquent households, but maybe half of them are in a repayment plan. So that needs to be clarified on this spreadsheet.
Let me clarify a little bit further. So there's 111 folks who have repayment agreements. There's 96 that are delinquent with no repayment agreement, not necessarily with no repayment agreement. Some of those 96 that are delinquent have a repayment agreement in place, but they are not paying on that repayment agreement.
Oh.
So they're not compliant.
Correct. So they're not only not compliant with normal lease rent paying, they're also not compliant with all of the opportunities that we've provided for them to sign repayment agreements and be in an agreement with us.
So they're only on they're only included in the 96 number of households delinquent if they are not maintaining their repayment plan.
Correct.
Oh. Well, I just want to note that this spreadsheet is a little bit unclear to me. I've got an MBA in finance. So if we could kind of clean this spreadsheet up and make it a little clearer, it'd be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we need to be very clear on this relative to the process, because what we need to know is, you know, you guys have to reach at some point to say, this is the bucket, this is what we've done. And at this particular point, then you could then take your actions. We're not suggesting that, you know, we automatically do that, but this has to be clear. What efforts you made, what effort they've made, and then those are people who are non-compliant, who are not responding, you have to take action.
Okay, we can look at how this is presented for the next meeting.
Yeah, and then, you know, making it clear so we then will know who's where and then what actions you have taken relative to that.
I see.
Someone else's hand is up?
Yes, yep. Alder Evers.
Alder Evers, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I do think it is important to see the overlap. Because those who have a repayment agreement and are not living up to it, one would argue have received more engagement and more possibilities to get back on track. So this first column, a total number of household delinquents, looks like could be some people who've simply fallen behind, but have not yet agreed to a repayment agreement and signed an agreement to pull it back in line. So, I do think disaggregating that a little bit would be helpful, because folks who have had that extra level of engagement and yet continue to fall behind might be appropriate candidates for next steps. But I have a more direct question. You may have addressed this already, Lynette. Is there an issue, or Matt, is there an issue regarding Caribous and Parkside that such a high percentage of those residents are delinquent? Is this perhaps I assume that they are on Section 8 and are not required to pay any more than a certain percentage of their income. Are there reasons why there are no payments at all, or people are falling behind in such high percentages in these two buildings?
Lauren, do you have any insight? Because are you referring to the delinquency rate or the percentage of households that are delinquent?
Well, the percentage of households that are delinquent for Parkside are highest, and the amount of overall delinquency amount are the highest as well. So granted, Caribous only has one person that's delinquent, but there aren't that many people living at Caribous. But Parkside has 19 relative, you know, that's one out of five people who live there. I'm just wondering what the deal is. Are management not engaging folks adequately who live in these two properties? Or is there a reason why, you know, this disparity exists? Or am I making more of this than is evident?
So I will tell you that the level of engagement with the Parkside and Caribous and the Brittingham and Gay Braxton residents has been the same since we've started this process. We're not really sure why folks at Parkside are not engaging as much in repayment agreements. So I don't have an exact answer for that, but it is also that the amount per person, so like the rent amount that is delinquent per person, is higher at Parkside than it is at our other sites.
Yeah, I can tell. I can see them. Yeah.
So that their monthly rent maybe is $600 instead of $200. So that's where some of it's coming from as well.
All right. Well, I guess we should keep an eye on that so that it doesn't get further out of hand. So thank you.
Any other questions? Anna?
Nope, I do not see any hands raised at this time.
Well, thank you for that report. I appreciate it. That brings us toward the end of the meeting. Matt, are there any other items that come before the board?
Nope. Actually, Chair, I apologize.
Go ahead, Anna.
Go ahead. I was going to say it was a little unclear for the approval of the minutes. So, Chair, would it be possible to redo that motion, please?
Are you unsure who made the motion?
Did the first move to approval, and I seconded.
You seconded? Okay. Thank you very much, Alder Offers.
Any other items, Matt?
Just one more reminder to fill out that disclosure form if you haven't already.
Yes, we don't want to be taken after school. So appreciate that. Well, thank you all very much for this meeting. Thank you, staff, for your presentations. And you guys have a wonderful evening and take care.
Can we have a motion to adjourn, please?
Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Motion for adjournment, please.
Move to adjourn.
Commissioner Gray, second.
It's been moved and seconded that we're in adjournment. Good night, folks.
Take care.